Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back to the program that helps you improve your American English. Today we have two stories for you. First, we will hear more on the dispute between the Philippines and China over who owns what in the South China Sea. And then we will look into the future as two women have announced that they want to be the next president of Taiwan. It looks like an all-Asia show today, so let's get started with part one. Ana Mateo leads things off.
A leading American security expert wants the United States to show support for the Philippines in its territorial dispute with China in the South China Sea. Walter Lohman is director of the Center for Asia Studies at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. He suggested that the U.S. declare Philippine-controlled islands and coral reefs in the disputed area under the protection of a security treaty between the two countries. Mr. Lohman made the suggestion to members of the U.S. House of Representatives. U.S. officials have repeatedly made a similar declaration on Japan and the Senkaku Islands, but they have not done so with the areas currently held by the Philippines in the South China Sea. China claims the Senkaku and calls them the Diaoyu Islands. Walter Lohman says now is the time for the U.S. to provide that kind of declaration to the Philippines. He spoke last week to the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He said, "I think we should change our position on the application of the U.S.-Philippine Security Treaty to cover features in the South China Sea that are currently occupied by the Philippines and under its jurisdiction. China claims most of the South China Sea. The Chinese government is actively working to develop artificial islands in the area. The Philippines is one of the loudest critics of China's territorial claims. After an incident between Chinese ships and the Philippine Navy 3 years ago, China took control of a rich fishing ground called Scarborough Shoal. The Philippines claims the area is within its exclusive economic zone. Some experts believe China will seek to demonstrate its control over the South China Sea by building military positions on the shoals. Mr. Lohman also told lawmakers that because Chinese aggression in the South China Sea, the U.S. should increase its military aid to the Philippines. He said, "I would suggest that Congress double the foreign military financing budget for the Philippines." Another thing, he said, is to get the Philippines the third Coast Guard boat that Philippine officials have requested. Congressman Brad Sherman is on the Asia-Pacific Subcommittee and a member of the Democratic Party. He expressed his concern that the South China Sea dispute would pull the United States into a war with China. The U.S. government has repeatedly said it is not taking sides on the disputes over the South China Sea, but it says free movement of shipping needs to be guaranteed. U.S. officials also have said that any disputes over sovereignty of the islands must be dealt with peacefully. Officials say the Chinese aggression in the South China Sea has made the Philippines even closer to strengthening its security alliance with the United States. Last year, the Philippine government signed an agreement that gives the U.S. military increased use of Philippine military bases. Last May, a U.S. airplane flew from Clark Air Base in the Philippines to study Chinese island-building activities. Earlier this month, the Philippine government announced its decision to reopen the former U.S. naval base at Subic Bay for military use. The decision leads to the possibility that U.S. forces may use the base again. I'm Ana Mateo.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Taiwanese voters are all but sure to elect a woman as their next president. The elections will be held in January. On Sunday, the ruling Nationalist Party chose Hung Shu-ju as its candidate. She is Taiwan's deputy legislative speaker and a former teacher. She will face Tsai Ing-wen, the head of the Democratic Progressive Party. Taiwan has never had two female candidates representing the major parties in presidential elections or elected a woman as president. Hung Shu-ju is the first female presidential candidate from Taiwan's ruling Nationalist Party. The opposition Democratic Progressive Party candidate, Tsai Ing-wen, was a candidate for president in 2012. But she lost to the man who is now president, Ma Ying-jeou. Women have become heads of state in India, South Korea, and other parts of Asia, but never in Taiwan. Philip Yang is a spokesman for the Nationalist Candidates Campaign. He says Taiwan stands out already because two women are competing.
Not in other countries that both the opposition, major opposition and ruling parties candidates are both female. So this is probably making this campaign very interesting.
Ms. Hung is 67 years old and a former teacher. She is known best for asking sharp and sometimes humorous questions of officials who are called into the legislature to explain the work of government. Her rival, Ms. Tsai, is 58 years old and a lawyer by training. She lost the 2012 presidential race by 6 percentage points to Ma Ying-jeou. Political observers say Taiwanese voters can accept a woman as president because their democracy has developed since it began in the late 1980s. Women over 50 were traditionally seen as able leaders in Chinese culture. A third of Taiwan's legislators are female. Women also lead some of the island's top businesses. As a sign that the sex of a candidate is a minor issue for voters, debate about the presidency has moved on to Taiwan's relationship with China. The government on the mainland has claimed sovereignty over self-ruled Taiwan since the 1940s. Chinese leaders want the two sides to unite, but studies show Taiwanese people choose the current form of autonomy. President Ma set aside political disputes with China in 2008 to open dialogue that has led to a series of economic agreements. Ms. Hung wants to keep up that dialogue on Beijing's condition that both sides see themselves as a single China. But she says there can be different ideas about what that means. Ms. Tsai also wants more contacts, but she rejects the One China justification for talks. This situation makes officials in Beijing nervous. Ross Feingold is with American political risk manager DC International Advisory. He says voters will consider each candidate's opinions on China policy and economic issues.
Both candidates have been publicers for a considerable amount of time, so there's certainly things to look at in their past record or their positions on current issues that are enough to talk about without making gender an issue.
Many Taiwanese want Taiwan to move slowly on its relationship with China. Surveys show Ms. Tsai leading her opponent with about 6 months before the vote. The winner replaced President Ma in May when he leaves office at the end of his term. You are listening to The Voice of America. We come to you every day from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Pakistani Malala Yousafzai is the youngest winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. On Sunday, July 12th, she celebrated her 18th birthday by opening a school in Lebanon. The school serves Syrian refugee girls in the Bekaa Valley. Ms. Yousafzai has been an education activist for years and at great risk. In 2012, Taliban gunmen shot the 15-year-old schoolgirl in the head. They said they did it because she supported education rights for females. Ms. Yousafzai survived the attack and continued to fight for education. In 2014, she won the Nobel Peace Prize. On Sunday, the activists spoke in a schoolroom surrounded by drawings of butterflies. She said people need to pay more attention to refugees from Syria.
I decided to be in Lebanon because I believe that the voices of the Syrian refugees need to be heard, and they have been ignored for so long.
Ms. Yousafzai also said leaders must buy books instead of bullets.
Today, on my first day as an adult, on behalf of world's children, I demand our leaders, we must invest in books instead of bullets. Books, not bullets, will pave the path towards peace and prosperity.
The Malala Fund is a non-profit organization that supports local education projects. It paid for the school in the Bekaa Valley, close to the Syrian border. Up to 200 girls aged 14 to 18 can attend the school. There are 1.2 million refugees from Syria's war in Lebanon. In all, 4 million people have fled to neighboring countries. There are about 500,000 Syrian children in Lebanon. Only about 100,000 of them are attending school. The sharp increase in the number of refugees in Lebanon has caused economic difficulty. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees says over half of Syrian refugees in Lebanon are under 18. Most of the refugees need humanitarian aid. 20% of the people now in Lebanon are refugees. Ms. Yousafzai said that Jordan and Lebanon are barring some Syrian refugees from entering their countries. She called the situation inhuman and shameful. At the Malala Yousafzai All-Girls School, students sang Happy Birthday and gave Ms. Yousafzai a birthday cake. Ms. Yousafzai said the girls did not need advice from her.
When I met these girls, and they're amazing, and I think they don't need any message, they don't need any other advice, because they know that education is very important for them.
For the VOA Learning English Education Report, I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of the presidency of George W. Bush. Bush began his second term and fifth year in office in January 2005. Early in his first term, terrorists had carried out the worst attacks in United States history. President Bush declared a war on terror and led the country into wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In his second inaugural address, he promised to continue fighting to defeat terrorism and increase democracy around the world.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
He also talked about his goals at home and what he called America's ideal of freedom.
In America's ideal of freedom, citizens find the dignity and security of economic independence instead of laboring on the edge of subsistence. By making every citizen an agent of his or her own destiny, we will give our fellow Americans greater freedom from want and fear and make our society more prosperous and just and equal.
The United States Constitution limits presidents to two terms. Presidential historian Russell Riley at the University of Virginia's Miller Center says presidents traditionally use their first term to focus on their major goals for the country. Second terms, he says, tend to be unhappy times. During his second term, Richard Nixon resigned over the attempt to hide political wrongdoing in the Watergate case. Bill Clinton faced a trial in the Senate over his attempt to hide a relationship with a young aide. But the first major problem of George Bush's second term dropped from the sky.
You saw people on the rooftops. You saw people using claw hammers trying to break through their attic to get up onto the roof. That's why you had so many people who drowned.
In August of 2005, Susan Bennett received a phone call from her daughter, a television reporter in New Orleans, Louisiana.
She called on a Friday and said, "I think you need to come and pick up my son because there's a really big storm coming."
It was Hurricane Katrina, one of the worst natural disasters in American history. Along the Gulf of Mexico, the hardest hit states were Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Over 1,800 people died. Property damage totaled more than $75 billion. But Katrina will be remembered mostly because of what happened in New Orleans. A day before the storm hit, officials had ordered everyone to leave the city. But thousands of people stayed. Some chose not to leave. Others were too poor, too old, or too sick to go. Then the levees broke. Those flood barriers were supposed to protect the city. Much of New Orleans was built on land that lies below sea level. As Katrina hit, more than 80% of the city flooded. In some areas, the water was 6 meters deep. Many people who stayed were caught in the floods. Officials struggled to get food, water, and medicine to the survivors. The displaced included thousands of people who took shelter in the Superdome, a big sports arena. Out on the streets, lawless acts fed a sense of disorder and helplessness.
It's disgusting and frustrating, and we are human beings, and they're treating us like we're criminals.
We want help! No fuck!
Susan Bennett helped create an exhibit about Hurricane Katrina at the museum, a museum of news in Washington.
Not only in this country, but also in newspapers across the world, you saw the same headline. It ranged from engulfed to our tsunami, chaos, and then it went to anarchy, national disgrace.
Congress later found that officials at every level of government, local, state, and federal, had failed in doing their jobs. President Bush flew over New Orleans to inspect the damage. A photograph showed him looking out the window of Air Force One at the ground below. Russell Riley at the University of Virginia says the picture expressed what many people were thinking about the handling of the disaster. In 2005, a different kind of storm was hitting Iraq. American and Iraqi officials were struggling to create a democratic government. Local militias were on the rise and attacking coalition forces and other Iraqis. The violence also included Al-Qaeda suicide bombings in Iraq, which angered many Iraqis. And there was international anger as the result of photos that showed American troops abusing Iraqi prisoners. President Bush had declared the end of major combat operations on May 1, 2003. That was less than 2 months after the invasion. But the numbers of civilian and military deaths were growing. And in the United States, surveys were showing that a growing number of Americans thought going into Iraq was a mistake.
The bad news was we were uncomfortable with it, and we wanted to get out, and we could not understand how things could go so terribly wrong.
Judith Yaffe joined the National Defense University after 20 years as a Middle East expert at the Central Intelligence Agency.
That's where the lack of strategy and the mismanagement come in. But I think it's also true that, you know, Americans just wanted to say, why are we in Iraq? Why are we in any of these places? Because historically speaking, it's not a role we've been comfortable with.
She says by President Bush's second term, few Iraqis wanted to cooperate with the Americans to make the country more secure. But President Bush said American troops could not leave until Iraqi forces replaced them. In 2006, an Iraqi court sentenced the country's former leader to death. Saddam Hussein was hanged for crimes against humanity. But nothing else seemed to change. Violence and insurgent attacks continued. Iraq seemed to be on the edge of being torn apart by civil war. Early the next year, President Bush announced that he was sending more troops to Iraq. He thought it would help stop the violence.
These troops will work alongside Iraqi units and be embedded in their formations. Our troops will have a well-defined mission to help Iraqis clear and secure neighborhoods, to help them protect the local population, and to help ensure that the Iraqi forces left behind are capable of providing the security that Baghdad needs.
The temporary increase of about 30,000 troops came to be called the surge. In September of 2007, the top commander in Iraq reported to Congress that the violence was decreasing. The surge may have helped create the conditions for this change, but there were other reasons as well. Middle East expert Judith Yaffe says many Iraqis decided to work with the Americans to defeat the insurgency.
The Iraqis themselves saw that this was a greater danger to them, that there was nothing to be gained. The Sunnis of Iraq in particular saw that Al-Qaeda was hurting them, that it was a danger to them, that there was much more to be gained by aligning with the U.S. forces.
By the time President Bush was finishing his second term, Iraqi and American officials had agreed on a withdrawal date to end the war. The last American forces would leave Iraq by the end of 2011. Russell Riley at the University of Virginia says it is too soon to know how history will judge the United States' actions in Iraq.
If Iraq proves to be a policy success, then the surge will be a critical turning point and a terrific exercise of presidential leadership.
He also points out that the war is not the only measure by which the 43rd president will be judged. Professor Riley put it this way: the great debate among historians will not be whether Bush was a powerful president or a consequential president, but whether he directed those powers in the most fruitful way that he could have. So what else was going on in the United States during this period? Millions of people were voting for which singer should get a recording contract on American Idol. Year after year, it was the most popular show on television.
Oh, Robert, I think you just killed my favorite song of all time.
Killed in a good way or a bad way?
I'm afraid. Well, listen, killing is never good.
Killing is never good.
It's never a happy killing.
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, I mean, that was first degree on that.
I need some shelter of my own protection, baby.
But the biggest story in music was not what people were listening to, but how. Sales of CDs in stores fell as more and more people downloaded songs from the internet. On iTunes, Fergie's Big Girls Don't Cry was the most downloaded song of 2007. For the first half of the decade, there seemed to be nothing to cry about in the American housing market. Home prices were going up and up, which made sellers happy. And lenders were offering bigger and bigger loans at easy terms and low interest rates, which made buyers happy. The government supported the easing of lending rules as a form of social policy, a way to help more people buy homes. Rates of home ownership, a part of the American dream, reached record highs. In 2005, nearly 7 out of 10 Americans owned their own home. But many home buyers had been given mortgage loans that they could not afford to pay back. And that was not the only problem. Banks had been selling those loans as securities to investors around the world. Everyone thought they were getting a good deal, the banks, the borrowers, the investors. But then the price bubble burst and the housing market collapsed. Many borrowers lost their homes because they were unable to make their monthly loan payments. That was the situation Karen Lucas and her husband of Cleveland, Ohio, found themselves in.
I've done my crying. I've made my peace, and I've put it in God's hands.
As home values fell, many people found themselves underwater, meaning they owed more on their mortgage than their house was worth. Suddenly, there was a lot to cry about. By the end of 2007, the economy was sliding into the Great Recession. That and the election of 2008 will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.